Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. This is your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the broader field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. Delighting in Khurram Hussain's consistently sparkling prose is reason enough to read his new book, Islam as Critique, Sayyid Ahmad Khan and the Challenge of Modernity. But there is much more to this splendid book, framed around the profoundly consequential, conceptual, and political question of can Muslims serve not as friends or foes, but as critics of Western modernity? Hussain addresses this question through a close and energetic reading of key selections from the scholarly corpus of the hugely influential yet often misunderstood modern South Asian Muslim scholar Sayyid Ahmad Khan. By putting Khan in contrapuntal conversation with a range of Western philosophers including Reinhold Niebuhr, Hannah Arendt and Alistair MacIntyre, Hussain explores ways in which Sayyid Ahmad Khan's thought on profound questions of moral obligation, knowledge, jihad, and time disrupts a politics of either-or, whereby Muslim actors are invariably grinded in the sledgehammer of modern Western commensurability to emerge as either friends or as enemies. This provocative and thoughtful book will animate the interest of a range of scholars in Islamic studies, South Asian studies, politics, philosophy, and post-colonial thought. It will also work as a great text to teach in courses on these and many other topics. Here now is my conversation with Professor Khurram Hussain. Hello, Khurram. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Khurram, for coming on the New Books Network on New Books in Islamic Studies. As we were just talking before we started recording, such an incredible book, which the thing that is quite remarkable is that it makes an intervention in multiple fields simultaneously. Scholars of Islam will have much to learn from it, scholars of South Asian history and South Asian Islam, but largely, questions of philosophy, post-colonial thought.
Right.
There's a lot of intersecting threads and that we'll try to capture here. But before we get specifically to the book, we have a tradition on the New Books Network forum that our first question is biographical. Could you share a bit with our listeners the story of how you became a scholar of Islam, philosophy, and so on? And then how did you get to write this particular book? Maybe share your journey a bit before we get to the book itself.
Great. I mean, I'm being from Pakistan. You know, my parents never thought I'd become this kind of doctor. You know, they always wanted me to be like an engineer and or a doctor, one of those things, right? A professional degree and stuff. And initially, I had come to college to get a degree, like a pre-engineering degree in Bowdoin College and then go to Caltech because it was a program, at Bowdoin where you went to Caltech to become an engineer. But then I got derailed on the way by my roommate, who was a philosophy and religion person. And then I started taking classes and then, the rest is history. I'm not, trained as an Islamicist. I think that might come through quite clearly in the book as well. My training has mostly been in philosophy of religion, and then philosophy as such, Western philosophy for the most part. So this book basically came about when I tried to read Islamic writers like Sayyid Ahmed Khan as if I was reading Western philosophy. Do you see what I'm saying? So like instead of sort of thinking about them in provincial terms as Islamic scholars or Islamic theologians or Islamic or South Asianists, right? I tried to imagine these writers in much the same way that I would read a Hegel or a Kant or a Nietzsche or something, right? So the book is really about like taking that particular way of thinking about these thinkers seriously, right? Like not try to provincialize them, but read them the way I would read anything else, right? Any other sort of piece of Western philosophy or theology.
Terrific. Let's perhaps begin with the title, which also serves as perhaps the major argument of the book,
right.
Islam as Critique. Tell us a bit to our listeners what you mean by that, and how does it connect to the central sort of point that you make in the book, that phrase Islam as Critique?
Well, I think critique to me, like, when we think about critical theory or critique as such, is sort of an intervention, right? Like when you take a particular point of view, a particular philosophy, as being critical of a particular understanding of the world, a particular ontology, epistemology, what you're saying is that there's a kind of internality to that thing, right? Like I think I'm referencing here Michael Walzer's idea of like the internal critic versus external critic, right? So to think of Islam as critique is to internalize Islam within modernity, right? To say Islam is not something outside of modernity that modernity happens to, right? Islam is a particular critical take, in the exposition of modernity as such, right? So it's a way of signaling that I'm trying to internalize Islam as a way of looking at the world, right? As a critical way of looking at the world, which is absolutely essential to the exposition of modernity as such.
And but the other key point that you of course make, and I perhaps you could speak a bit more about this, is this critical point you make about looking at Muslims neither as a friend or foe, but right. as critics. Tell us a bit about what you mean there, and why is that so central? Why is that so important to what you try to do in this book?
I think a lot of my when I started looking at Islam, modern Islam especially, or writings about modern Islam, especially in the contemporary media and also in the writings of people as well, like I kept seeing this sort of like this either or kind of phenomena, like either you are a friend or you're an enemy, right? Either you are commensurable with Western modernity or you're completely rejecting it, right? Like so this is sort of the this binary way in which Muslims are either sort of accepted as friends, meaning like they are just like us, like Muslims are just like Muslims are people too, that kind of reading, right? The Islamophilia almost, or like Muslims are sort of ISIS and Al Qaeda or just rejecting modernity. So the point was that when I say critic, like I'm not using critic in a negative sense, right? I'm not saying critic in the sense of like a rejection, but criticism as a way of being in the world with other people, right? Like if I, for example, like the way we are talking right now, right? Like this is a particular example of critical debate, right? Like you say something, I say something back, then you say something, I say something back, and then we both sort of grow from that experience of talking to each other, right? So I think the primary sort of motivation for writing the book is that I find too little of that happening with Muslim thinkers in the global public mainstream, right? Like including academia, but mostly in sort of the way we talk about Muslims, right? We do hear about Muslims, a very good example would be some like Reza Aslan, right? Who's so anodyne, right? Like he's so completely anodyne. So he's everything that he writes about is basically just anodyne liberal, masquerading as a Muslim, right? And to me, that seems like almost as bad as like the sort of rejectionist fundamentalists, right? Who basically say everything that's Western, everything that's modern is bad.
And if you make the argument that a figure who is really useful, of course, I mean, that's one of the key interventions of the book, that who disrupts this kind of a commensurability paradigm, right, is of course, this 19th century scholar, Syed Ahmad Khan.
Right.
So tell us a bit to our listeners, maybe those who might be a bit unfamiliar with the South Asian context, maybe if you could situate a bit about your take on Syed Ahmad Khan versus the earlier scholarship, but also why is he so useful for your purposes? Why is he so apt as an example of a scholar who disrupts this commensurability or this either-or paradigm?
Well, I think in many ways, like, I think one of the points of this book and my other work is that in many ways, the contemporary moment is not so different, right, from its 19th century antecedents, right? In many ways, a lot of the debates we're having were already happening in the 19th century. So one of the things I talk about in the book is that in many ways, Syed Ahmad Khan's time period, especially after the mutiny in 1857, when the British colonial authorities were challenged by, you know, sporadic sort of warfare, you know, attempts to overthrow the imperial, you know, the company rule at the time. Syed Ahmad Khan's response to that particular situation was precisely to not play the game of, like, either pledge loyalty to the crown or pledge loyalty to Islam, right? Like, his point was, well, how do we make this particular moment in South Asia at the time, a moment in which we can sort of create something new, right? And to fully understand the novelty of the moment through an exposition of a new kind of Islam, like a new ilm al-kalam, as he talks, a new sort of theological take. And I think we need that kind of sort of attitude in modern, that particular way of thinking about the world, I feel like is in short supply. And it's not just in short supply, like philosophically, right? I think there's lots of great philosophical works being done, but normatively, and you know, in a sense of like how do we deal with this particular moment without falling into this either or trap? So that's why I find him very useful, is because he did not, you know, even though like that time period would have you know, been quite you know, it would have been quite easy for him to fall into that trap, as many of his co-religionists did at the time. But he didn't.
And one of the key categories that you present in terms of his work is this idea of harmonization or tadbiyah, as you put it. Tell us a bit about what that entails for Syed Ahmad Khan. What does that mean, the harmonization of?
Well, the actual concept of tadbiyah is actually earlier than him. It was Shah Waliullah, who's another reformer from the 18th century. He came up with this idea of tadbiyah as a way of harmonizing all the different schools of Islamic thought and jurisprudence, and also harmonizing between the Sufi way and the ulama way, and even, you know, even broader, like, you know, harmonizing between Shias and Sunnis. So it was this very panoramic type of concept that Shah Waliullah came up with, you know, and as he tried to sort of, you know, unify all the different kinds of quote unquote Islam in South Asia at the time into a single sort of coherent narrative, right? And, you know, so tadbiyah as a kind of like operationalized version of tawhid, which means sort of obviously, you know, unicity of God, right? So tadbiyah sort of as the human social cultural equivalent of the ontological concept of tawhid. Now, Syed Ahmad Khan means much the same by it, right? He's using the term in a similar way to Shah Waliullah, but in a different context, right? He's trying to harmonize. In his understanding, he's trying to harmonize all the different aspects of human life, right? Like, for example, like he's trying to say that we cannot think about human life as being divided up into 15, 16 different categories, right? Like, we can't think of it as being separate, like secular and state versus religion versus dunya versus, you know, so all of these sort of different disparate sort of fragmented aspects of Muslim identity and Muslim life at the time. He's saying we need to kind of bring it all together into a single coherent narrative, right? Like turn it into like a... So think of it this way. Like it's not so much that it's trying... Tadbiyah refers to like making everything the same or everything similar, but it's like the coherence of a language, for example, right? When we're talking right now, there's a kind of coherence, harmonized coherence to language, right? Like the sentences have a certain kind of grammar to them. They have a certain vocabulary to them, right? What Syed Ahmad Khan was noticing in late 19th century India was that Islam as a language for understanding yourself and the world had become incoherent, right? And it had become incoherent because parts of it had just fragmented and become obsolete and obscure. So he was trying to create a new language, right? Like a new way of thinking about the world and the word he used, the concept he used to define and put together and sort of construct this new language was Tathbiya. Right? So the problem being that Muslims were no longer being able to talk coherently about the world in a way that kind of presented itself to them as a unified, you know, like a some kind of coherent entity.
You've already touched on this, but before we get to the specific themes of Syed Ahmad Khan that you engage, I just wanted you to say a bit about this sort of way in which you've organized the book and the kind of intervention that you launch, in that you put Syed Ahmad Khan in what you call a contrapuntal conversation with major Western philosophers and theorists, especially Hannah Arendt, Niebuhr, and Alistair MacIntyre.
Right.
And you make a very interesting point that you're trying to rethink the idea of contextualizing these Muslim thinkers in their particular time period. Tell our listeners a bit about that argument. Why was this contrapuntal conversation important to you, and how are you trying to sort of go beyond this idea of contextualizing Muslim thinkers in their own places and time periods and so on?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm not against contextualization. I mean, I think, you know, part of the cultural turn that happened in the 70s and 80s and in academia in general was, I think, very necessary to try and put things in context and not always use sort of Western models to describe everything. Right. I mean, that was the problem back in the day. Right. Like we had a sort of a overwhelming kind of gaze of the West sort of describing the world in Western terms. So contextualizing, you know, like postcolonial studies and like cultural studies, right, to try and understand human phenomena in context is generally a good thing, right? Like it's a corrective to failed sort of universalisms of the past. But at the same time, I feel that there is a kind of loss attendant to over-contextualization, right? Because when you over-contextualize somebody, like Syed Ahmad Khan, you basically say that he has nothing to say that is relevant to the human condition as such. Right, like I, as a humanist, and I would describe myself as a humanist, I'm really interested in the human dimensions of all people, right? Like of all events, of all phenomena, no matter where they happen, right? So, but what I mean by decontextualizing Syed Ahmad Khan is not to say like, hey, he's not a South Asian, 19th century South Asian Muslim reformer, right? Like that's context, right? But what is his relevance to the human condition as such, right? Like what can we as human beings learn from him, right? And that I think about as reading, like, you know, reading him out of context. Not so much out of context in the sense of like just completely erasing his particularity, but to engage with him as we engage with a lot of Western philosophers, right? Like we engage with them without this constant interrogation of their biographies, right? I mean, you can talk to, and you know, like you can talk to people who've been steeped in Western philosophy and they wouldn't know a damn thing about Kant or Hegel and their biography or where they were from or what they were doing or like what were their particular religious affiliations and all that stuff. Right? And I'm not saying it's a bad thing to know that stuff, but what I'm saying is that sometimes you can engage with these people purely on the terms of their ideas. Right? I know that's not very fashionable, especially in our present moment, but sometimes you can just look at the ideas and just, you know, and stay with that. That's what one of the reasons I began with the book with Ahmadinejad, right? Like saying, listen, I mean, I understand, you know, there's a lot of sort of problematic aspects to Ahmadinejad, but sometimes it is important to just read, you know, what is written. Do you see what I'm trying to get at? Like just to read what is written and engage with that at a human level. So that was the approach. And then in terms of the contrapuntal, I think pretty much what I've already said, right? Like I want to read Syed Ahmad Khan with the other people that I read, much like I read Hannah Arendt with Nietzsche or Hegel, right? I want to read him into the same conversation, right? And I want to be able to sort of just make that conversation available to other people, right? Like other people can then look at this particular book and say, hey, listen, it's not that complicated or weird to read Syed Ahmad Khan next to Reinhold Niebuhr. Right, like it just as it's not weird to read Reinhold Niebuhr next to Kant. Right, they're just as far removed in many ways, you know, from each other geographically and historically and you know temperament wise. Right, like so there's nothing like peculiarly peculiar about Syed Ahmad Khan or Muslim thinkers. Right, we're all living in a modern world that is hyper connected, right? Maybe back 1,000 years ago, there might have been like sort of, you know, zones of exclusive particularity, right? We don't have those zones anymore. We certainly haven't had them for the last 200 years, right? So I think we need to begin to begin to pull these people out of their context, you know, in a way to humanize the discourse surrounding
it. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So now let's get to some of the specific ways in which you conduct this contrapuntal conversation. One of the key ideas in Syed Ahmed Khan that you explore at in depth is this idea of taklif, or you know, which has a certain notion of moral obligation, but then sort of the notion of burden and so on in the South Asian context.
Right.
So tell us a bit about what Syed Ahmed Khan does with this notion of taklif, and then how you put that into conversation with Niebuhr. I know this was a massive chapter with a lot going on, but maybe...
My publisher was like, can you please break it into two? I was like, can't do it. You know,
it's a I'm glad you didn't. It was fantastic. But maybe could give us a sense of the gist of this chapter and what you do with taklif and Niebuhr. Yeah.
Well, taklif, you know, taklif is historically, right, it's a fiqh concept. It's a very legalistic concept, right? It refers to the moral obligation that human beings are put under by God, right? Like the human beings have to. It's the mechanism. It's the conceptual theological mechanism by which humans are held accountable, basically, right? So they're under obligation to do right, you know. So what Syed Ahmed Khan does is very interesting, because as you know, Shirley, like taklif in Urdu has a very different meaning usually, right? Like in Urdu, taklif also just literally means pain, right? So Syed Ahmed Khan does this very interesting thing, because Syed Ahmed Khan is the first major writer who does theology in South Asia in Urdu, not in Arabic, right? He's able to use this term and its much wider connotative domain in Urdu to make a real interesting intervention, right? Theological intervention. So he's able to make taklif not just a kind of moral obligation, but connect it with the idea of human limitation and the pain, the painfulness or the burden of being a human being, of being situated, being limited, right? In one's capacity to be able to see and to hear and to experience, right? So he takes this concept, which is a fairly dry, you know, theological, legalistic concept, and he turns it into this kind of an ontological claim about the human condition, right? That human beings are the kind of creature that are limited, unlike God, right? God has a limitless omniscience, omnipotence. Human beings are situated, biologically situated, physically situated, historically situated, and they're by definition finite. And this finitude, right? This finitude is what taklif is for Syed Ahmed Khan, right? That finitude is in fact not just the fact of the finitude, but Syed Ahmed Khan locates the human capacity to reason and the human capacity for freedom precisely in this finitude. I think this is sort of the big intervention, right? Which is that Syed Ahmed Khan does not locate or does not understand freedom and reason, right? Abstractly. He understands it very, very particularly as an aspect of human finitude, of taklif, right? So that freedom is not something, I think I've used the idea that freedom is a particular kind of epiphenomenal to the condition of being put under obligation by God, right? It's sort of like it's counterintuitive, right? Like it's usually you would say, hey, if you're under pain and obligation, you have your freedom is limited, right? But Sayyidina Khan imagines human freedom, human reason as precisely the human response, right, to being put under obligation, to being finite, right? So he takes this particular, you know, counterintuitive sort of approach to try and locate the capacity to reason and the capacity for freedom in being a finite being. Now, in that sense, his particular understanding of Taklif Haqs is very similar when I was reading it to Sayyidina Khan, to Reinhold Niebuhr's understanding of sin in Christian theology, right? In Christian theology, or Reinhold Niebuhr's version of it, he also understands the human capacity for reason as being located in human finitude. And he understands sin not in an Augustinian sort of sexual physical way, but rather the sin of one's of the sin as like the finite condition of being human, while at the same time being able to imagine infinitely, right? So this combination of things, the finitude of the human condition and the human capacity for imagination, right, in a kind of tension with each other that gives rise to the human capacity for reason. So it's I thought when I was reading, I've read Niebuhr. I've been exposed to Niebuhr for a long time, much longer than Sayyidina Khan. So once I started reading Sayyidina Khan, I was reading into Sayyidina Khan, right? Some of what I'd already read in Niebuhr, right? So this is also what I mean by reading into, right? So I was reading into Sayyidina Khan, a particular kind of reading of Taklif that was very informed by my understanding of Reinhold Niebuhr's idea of sin.
And before we get to the next chapter, there is another very interesting thing you do in this chapter, which is Sayyid Ahmad Khan's reading of temporality and especially of Jahiliya sort of poetry, but also the Jahiliya time period and what the kind of intervention that Islam marked, this notion of time that we saw, that you also then juxtapose with Niebuhr's idea of morality being the flow of time and so on.
Right.
Tell us a bit about that also, because it's such an important part of this chapter. I didn't want to miss it.
Yeah, so Sayyid Ahmad Khan wrote like an entire history of the Arab people, you know, and it's completely Orientalist. So it's not very good, let me just say. Like, you know, he's not a historian. But he wrote a biography of the Prophet, and the first two chapters are all about talking about, you know, the period before the Prophet, the Jahiliya, as it's called. And one of the aspects of Jahiliya that Sayyid Ahmad Khan is very sort of interested in sort of engaging with is this idea of dahar or of time, right? The Jahiliya understanding of time, the pre-Islamic understanding of time in the Arabian Peninsula, is not just time as a kind of abstract stage on which things are happening, but time as sort of a destroyer of things, right? Time is fate, like in the old Greek sense, right? Like time consumes everything, right? It has no beginning, no end. It's just this constant consuming, overwhelming force, right? That just like devastates everything, right? What the kind of attitude that then that creates in the pre-Islamic Arab is, according to Sayyid Ahmad Khan, a certain kind of nihilistic assertiveness, right? Like nihilism, because time will take everything at some point, right? Like so just enjoy. So this is the kind of a nihilistic Epicurean sort of hedonism, right? So just enjoy the wine, enjoy women, enjoy violence and all that stuff. And a kind of assertiveness born of the idea that, well, if there's no other standard by which you can be judged other than just being consumed by time, then you should just continuously sort of assert yourself, you know, over others, right? So there's a kind of a nihilist, almost Nietzschean kind of aspect to it. And what according to Khan, what Islam does is take that particular combination of an understanding of time without beginning or end, right? Where the only thing that's really relevant is life and the living of life, right? And reconfigure it almost entirely, almost invert it almost entirely, right? By making time constrained in the Islamic context of beginnings and ends, right? Like the beginning of time and the end to time. And by making time into this kind of a, how should we say it? Like by making time instead of like an abstract, instead of like a mere consumer of things, but rather a kind of stage on which the human drama can play out, It fundamentally sort of reconfigured. So Khan's idea was that the reason why the Quran was revealed to the Arabs is because the pre-Islamic Arabs are the most unlike they're sort of the worst or the most extreme example of like this notion of assertive hedonism, right? So that the particular reorientation of the Arabs is the prime example of how Islam is designed to transform the human condition as such, right? So this is what, I combined it with Niebuhr's idea of the morality of the flow of time, is that time only flows in the sense that, you know, if events are not just random things that are happening in time, but rather events flow in a particular direction because we have a moral code as human beings, right? Because of morality, time has a kind of meaning other than just the happening of it, other than just consuming of the human condition.
The next key theme you explore is that of jihad. And again, there you bring in Hannah Arendt and her notions of political action and so on. What does Sayyid Ahmad Khan, how does Sayyid Ahmad Khan understand this category of jihad? How does it depart from perhaps earlier Muslim understandings? And how is that politically productive? And in what ways do you put that into conversation with Arendt?
Well, I think one of the things that I've noticed like recently in academia, but also like in general discussions, is that you get this idea that, oh, you know, jihad is not really holy war. Jihad is like about internal transformation. And, you know, that's true, but it's also not true. Like jihad has always had many different meanings, as you know, within the Muslim context, right? It's always had the meaning. Sufis have a different understanding of jihad. You know, state actors have a different understanding of jihad. So jihad is a panoramic concept, has lots and lots of different meanings, always been there, always been that way, right? Sayyid Ahmad Khan's particular reading of jihad really has to do with let me put it this way. So of the things that British introduced in India, right, the legal infrastructure, the, you know, state infrastructure, science, philosophy, whatever else, right, the one thing that Sayyid Ahmad Khan thought was the most important, right, was freedom of the press, right, or the idea that we should have spaces in which we can openly discuss all matters of public interest, right? So what Sayyid Ahmad Khan tried to do was to reinterpret or like reorient the idea of struggle or jihad, right? Of Muslim struggle, specifically Muslim struggle, and reconfigure it and attach it to this idea of ilm, right? Of knowledge, right? That somehow there's a kind of jihad that is oriented towards the production of knowledge and the sharing of knowledge and of debate, right? Like debating the public good, right? And so so it's not so much I'm saying like that his concept of jihad is somehow better or superior to other concepts of jihad. I mean, I think that's just, that's nonsense. I mean, like there's all different kinds of, it's, like I said, it's a panoramic concept. Lots of people have talked about it in lots of different ways, and that's fine. But Sayyid Ahmad Khan tried to tried to sort of say, well, okay, well, jihad is extremely important, but let's think about jihad in terms of like this, in terms of the freedom to debate, right, to debate things. And he made that not just as a kind of ethical thing. For Sayyid Ahmad Khan, the idea of debating or the idea of conversation and of free expression, right, is also an epistemological concept. You can't get to the truth of things, according to him, without these kinds of conversations, right? This is where he gets very close to somebody like Mill, right? Like John Stuart Mill, is that there is a way in which, like, it's not just a good thing, like politically speaking, to be able to express yourself, right? It's not just a good thing ethically. It's actually attendant to epistemological rigor in order to actually sort of, you know, so it's almost like a sort of, like a vaguely similar to like the scientific method almost, right? As you know, like Sayyid Ahmad Khan was knighted by the British Sir Sayyid Ahmad Khan. And part of the reason he was knighted was because he was against political agitation against the British, right? He always said that, you know, that's not a very good use of, the time of Muslims in the late 19th century. He was much more interested in using his time, for example, in forming publications, journals, gazettes, and obviously famously founded the MAO College, which later became the Aligarh University. So those kinds of activities for him were much more attendant to his particular conception of what jihad should be like in the context of late 19th century India. Right? And when reading, like, you know, some of the stuff that he writes about, and I think I quote him quite extensively in this chapter, I was very struck by how, in many ways, how Aristotelian this particular concept is, right? Like, in some ways, and this makes sense. I mean, the Islamic tradition is very heavily influenced by classical thinkers. But especially Aristotelian in the way that Hannah Arendt reread Aristotle, right? Which is the idea of politics as a kind of constant conversation about the public good, about the common good, about the good life, right? Is a conversation that is about itself in that sense, right? Like, it's not a conversation about something other than itself. The conversation itself is the playing out of politics, right? So, and that to me, like, was very, very, I mean, it was very sort of almost jarring in a good way when I first started reading Sayyid Ahmed Khan and reading into him the stuff that I was learning from Hannah Arendt.
That's a good segue into the next chapter in discussion, Aristotle, because what you show in the last substantive chapter of the book is these very interesting intimacies or points of convergence between Alistair MacIntyre and Sayyid Ahmed Khan on questions of wisdom and knowledge and tradition and so on.
Right.
And of course, Aristotle is very key to that argument. So tell us a bit about that argument. You spend a lot of time with MacIntyre and then connect him to the question of knowledge and wisdom in Sayyid Ahmed Khan. Tell us a bit about the argument of that chapter and why this convergence? What is your theory of this convergence?
Well, I think it really is that there's a way in which, I think what MacIntyre is saying is that there's an Aristotelian sort of understanding, right, of, you know, means of ends, right? So Aristotle really is a philosopher of ends, right? Ends not in the sense of like the end of things, but like the ends, meaning what is the essence of things, right? Like, what is the thing's end? Like, what is the meaning of that thing? What is the meaning of life, right? Life is a story, has a meaning, right? And so I think that kind of arc, this understanding of virtues, of habituses, of character, these are all things that are, according to MacIntyre, have been sort of devastated by the, you know, the rise of sort of the liberal conceptions of time, liberal conceptions of the human person, you know, hyper-individualism, all that stuff, right? So what MacIntyre is trying to say is that, listen, you know, we have to account for a particular conception of the human, of human life and of the meaning of human life, you know, that is rooted in an already pre-existing context, right, which is the tradition, right? So we cannot, so for MacIntyre, there's no way to evaluate the meaning of a particular life without the context within which that life happens, so to say, the life world which grounds sort of the story of that person, right? I think this particular way of thinking about a human person is very, very similar to the way, say, Sayyid Ahmed Khan sort of imagines it, right? That there is a way in which, like, the story of the human person in any particular context needs to be told vis-a-vis the tradition within which that person is embedded. Not, again, neither MacIntyre nor Khan are saying is that somehow that is the only way you can read a human story, right? That's not the point of the tradition. But the tradition is what makes these stories coherent, right? Whereas sort of the liberal conceptions of the individual as radically sort of, you know, radically sort of independent, so to say, vis-a-vis, you know, that person's dignity or that person's narrative coherence is almost incoherent to MacIntyre, right? And to a certain extent, I think to Khan as well. The way this chapter, you know, the idea of knowledge and wisdom, right, is that wisdom is the mechanism, right, by which we can actually accumulate knowledge in a meaningful way, right? Not as a kind of a just knowledge for knowledge's sake, which is what the liberal model seems to be doing for, according to MacIntyre, right? Like, for example, like MacIntyre talks about, like, all the different spheres of human activity within sort of the modern liberal model, they each seem to operate on this kind of model of, like, just more accumulation, right? Like, so scientific knowledge, you've heard, I'm sure, you know, people say, well, science for science's sake, you know, we just, knowledge for knowledge's sake, right? You just keep accumulating knowledge because you just want more knowledge, right? same thing applies to the economic models, right? Like, what do we say? You know, just make more money, right? Like, just money, accumulation of money is an end in itself, right? You can say the same thing about, you know, consumptive models. So, so what Magnet is identifying in the modern condition, the problem, is mass knowledge accumulation without a kind of coherent wisdom to organize that knowledge, right? And that coherent wisdom is a repository of tradition, right? Without tradition, you can't really have that. You can't really have a coherent sort of model for doing this, right? And this is where I think Sayyid Ahmed Khan's concept of Islam comes in, right? For Sayyid Ahmed Khan, Islam is a name, right, for the organization of human knowledge in all different spheres, right, in such a way as to enhance human flourishing. This is what I meant when I think I mentioned in the book, like that what Sayyid Ahmed Khan has in mind with Islam is a kind of a grand humanism, right? It's dehumanism to ground all other humanisms, right? So for Khan, the loss of Islam is then not just some kind of a provincial loss, according to him, right? It's not just a loss of a particular kind of quote-unquote religion. It's a loss of a certain kind of opportunity, right, for human flourishing. So that was the thing, that the idea of knowledge and wisdom is something that it seems wisdom is not something that even in modern philosophy, like it's not a concept that gets much play anymore. But I thought like it would be a good use of that particular concept, especially the way McIntyre uses the idea of tradition to try and like sort of, you know, retrieve a little bit of this idea of wisdom.
Before we talk about the epilogue, since the book is on critique, let me take a step back from the book itself and ask you a possible critique that someone might have, and I would be very curious how you would respond to that, or how you would think with that, perhaps, is that what if someone might say that as much as it's very productive what you're doing with Sayyid Ahmed Khan, and that you're not reading him in this very typical ways of him being a modernist or, you know, someone who's trying to establish the compatibility of Islam and modernity, but you're trying to show that he has a double critique. On the one hand, he's critical of his co-religionists, but also of the project of colonialism and so on. So you're complicating him, which is really productive. But what about sort of his co-religionists, so to say, the sort of other kinds of actors on the scene, the traditionalists and so on? Is there a way in which perhaps Sayyid Ahmed Khan's depiction of them is being taken at face value? Where is the ambiguity of those actors? Is Sayyid Ahmed Khan an appealing, attractive actor to you because he seems to be particularly apt for this kind of a critique of either or politics that you're launching? But is there a way in which the ambiguity and perhaps some productive aspects of those other kinds of actors that Sayyid Ahmed Khan was engaged in debates with, right, etc., might be sort of left out? I would just be curious how you would respond to that, because that would be, I would imagine that to be sort of reaction.
I think it's a completely fair critique. And the only thing I would say is that, obviously I think Sayyid Ahmed Khan is a lot of his writing is quite clearly, very, let me put it this way. Sayyid Ahmed Khan is clearly not above sort of caricatures of like the people that he's debating, just as he's caricatured, right? So it's not so much that Sayyid Ahmed Khan is somehow, more reliable as a narrator of his particular situation. But what I didn't want to do in this particular book was, again, like I said earlier, was situate him too well in his context, right? Like, I didn't want to put him in a situation where I'm spending like a lot of time, exploring or debating his location, discursive location. I wanted to pull him out of that location, right? So I do mention here and there a few people, in his particular time period, like Hali, I mentioned Iqbal a little bit later, right? But I didn't really want to explore that particular context too much, right? Because the point of the exercise is to kind of pull him out of there, right? Mm-hmm. It's pull him out and into like a conversation with completely different people, right? Mm-hmm. But in terms of like his particular, as you know, I mean, you look at the same time period, I think, in your work especially. You know, if I like, I could do like a book. I mean, I'm not going to, but I could do a book. You know, finding like a Deobandi person or something, right? In that time period, and do the same kind of thing, right? Because each of these people have complicated takes on modernity, right? The idea that somehow, like, you know, there is even the ones who, even what I'm getting at is that even self-professed Muslim, you know, people who are much more saying, even people who are self-professedly anti-Western, right, can be read productively with Westerners, right? So the fact that I was doing this with Sayyid Ahmed Khan is in some ways quite incidental. Like, I didn't go out, you know, I didn't choose him, you know, for the fact of his being sort of, you know, I mean, he's clearly easier for my purposes, right, than doing somebody else, like some of the people that you look at. But if I was better trained in Islamic studies, if I knew more about that particular time period, I think you can do this kind of a critical reading of all, any of these folks with other people in Europe and elsewhere.
Right. No, I think that's actually really useful. And it really is in some ways a great example of a decolonial exercise in which you're showing that, you know, someone, a South Asian Muslim thinker can be read alongside these other thinkers who usually populate the syllabi of courses on, you know, philosophical thought or theories and methods and so on. So,
right, exactly.
I mean, someone like Sayyid Ahmed Khan is deeply theoretical in his own right, is what he showed, which is incredible, which is really important. Just as a quick follow-up, just for the benefit of people who will write on Sayyid Ahmed Khan moving onwards and so on. Clearly, you know, after your book, it's very difficult to categorize him or label him as a modernist, which is the sort of default in Western writing. What would you recommend? What kind of a category would you recommend, if any? Should one just call him a political theorist or a Muslim scholar?
I really don't have a problem with modernist. You know, okay. I mean, I just want to redefine what modernism means. You know, like, okay. I feel like modernism has gotten a really bad rap. Mm-hmm. You know, as some kind of like quaint and old fashioned. I mean, mm-hmm. I would consider myself a modernist. I think I mentioned in the book, like, right. You know, I go with the idea of modernism is just, you know, modernism is people trying to sort of make a home for themselves in the modern, you know, in modernity, which is like all of these, you know, various processes. So right. Modernism is fine. I think my concern is when modernist versus something, right? Like, it's like when modernist becomes a, you know, because usually what you get in a lot of anthologies is modernist and fundamentalists or something.
Right. Right.
Or liberals versus like radicals. So, I mean, that, it's like the binary that's the problem, not the term itself. So, I mean, I have no problem with modernist as long as it's not in some kind of a, you know, like a binary with some, you know, with whatever else is you usually find, right? Like these, I mean, as your work shows, like, I mean, some of these terms are just really not very useful when they're in a particular kind of discursive architecture. But, you know, once you remove them from that architecture, you know, then I'm, you know, personally, I'm fine with that.
Right. And especially as you show with someone like Sayyid Ahmed Khan, who's deeply steeped in a what one might call a traditionalist training and worldview and networks of scholars. That is his world, but that...
He's a conservative, right? He's a conservative. That's a much better term for him if you don't put conservative in that binary again, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He's conservative in the sense... He's a Republican conservative in a small r, small c, right? That's what he is. Like, if you really want to read him as a thinker, you know, he's interested in conservation, right? But he's also interested in the Republican ideal, so to say, of building community and stuff. So that's... But do you see how, like, you know, if I say that, considering the, you know, the contemporary scholarship on Sayyid Ahmed Khan, there would be like people would, head would explode, right? Like, we're like, what are you talking about? He's not a conservative. So I'm saying, like, just like with any other, you know, Western philosopher, we have these particular much more complicated terms to describe them, right?
Right.
Which, you know, terms that attend to what their thinking is actually like, not the particular disposition that some Western person has towards them, right?
Like,
defining Sayyid Ahmed Khan vis-a-vis dispositionally rather than theoretically and philosophically, I think that's the problem, right? So the terms themselves, I feel like, are not the problem so much. Right. It's the particular discursive architecture within which these terms are embedded.
One other question, and then we'll really get to the epilogue, that I think for many readers will come up, and that's not part of your project, but I think it's perhaps you can just speculate a bit on this, is sort of the afterlife of Syed Ahmed Khan in the post-colonial moment in India and in Pakistan in very different sort of ways. What's your sense of the sort of legacy and how, I mean, this question often comes up in the context of Iqbal, but I think Syed Ahmed Khan is equally, if not more interesting in this respect.
Oh, absolutely.
What's your sense of his afterlives and how, what are some productive possibilities in both of these contexts of India and Pakistan today in terms of reading?
Well, much like Iqbal, right? He's one of the few sort of figures that are sort of almost equally revered in some ways, you know, in both India and Pakistan for very different reasons. Like in Pakistan, I remember growing up always hearing that Syed Ahmed Khan was the founder of the idea of Pakistan, right? Like he's like the first one, and then we heard all about his, you know, I mean, as I'm sure you did too, right? And in India, he's obviously known more for his educational interventions and in, you know, formed, you know, the Mohammedan Anglo-Oriental College, which later became Aligarh University. So there's that particular track. So he's been sort of appropriated by the nationalist sort of historiographies of you know, both countries in ways that are just very, I would say depressing, you know, because what that did is like it converted somebody who was like a, it would be as if the only way we read Hegel, right, was as a tourist of the state of Germany. You know, like, you know what I mean? Like, instead of like thinking about like the phenomenology of spirit or like, you know, the philosophy of history, we're like, yeah, the German state, that's what Hegel was really writing about, right? So I feel like that's what has happened with the nationalist, you know, appropriations of Syed Ahmed Khan is like a kind of hollowing out of his intellectual, overt, which is absolutely astounding. Like, I have the complete works, right? It's 16 volumes, like 8,000 pages. Do you see what I mean? Like this is an incredibly productive scholar, incredibly productive thinker, who's rigorous and sophisticated and complex and just brilliant in so many ways. And yet all we hear about it, right, in Pakistan and India are these like minuscule kind of refrains, these caricatured refrains, you know, about this person, you know, from both well-wishers and ill-wishers, right? And that's, you know, it's really unfortunate, you know. Like, I think, like, if people were to engage with his work, you know, in a more sort of sophisticated way, in a more complex way. I mean, this book, like I said, I mean, this book is barely scratching the surface, right? Yeah, of like just the surface of the surface of his work, right? And I wish, like, you know, if nothing else, like if somebody reads this book and they're more interested in reading him again, and getting really diving deep into it. I mean, one of the things that I want to do at some point, perhaps, is do more of the translation work, right? Like, because something like 80% of his work is not even translated in English yet. So, you know, that might be a project we can, you know, to work on at some point.
You end the book again in the present, and that's of course a key sort of register of the book that you see throughout, that you're trying to connect a 19th century thinker with these really existential questions that have to do with the present. And you you focus on, or you use the example of a contemporary scholar of Islam, Yasir Qadhi, in an episode to do with him. Tell us a bit about that very moving epilogue. What you do in that epilogue?
Well, I think, I mean, I know Yasir personally. I mean, I haven't, you know, spoken to him many years now, but we were in graduate school together. So I know Yasir's politics are very controversial, right? I mean, I'm sure you followed his particular take on things as well. He's fairly conservative. He's a member of sort of the Salafiyah. I think what I was trying to get at with the epilogue was just to show how the inability or the unwillingness to treat Muslims as critics, right, as people who can critically engage with their lives here or elsewhere, what that looks like, right, in the contemporary age, right? Like somebody like Yasir Qadhi, who in many ways is, you know, he might be, you know, theologically and philosophically far more conservative than I would like, or you would like, or anybody else might like. But somebody who's really trying to be a modern, right? Like he's trying to make a home. Like he's trying to become at home in this world, right? Where he belongs, is being sort of constantly undercut, right? By not just sort of, you know, sort of the powers that be, but in the very act of being able to speak his own existence to speak his own existence coherently into the world, into the public sphere, is becoming impossible for him, right? Now, the particular piece that I mentioned, you know, the New York Times piece on him was written, I think, in 2010. So I don't know what's happened in the last 9 years with Yasser, but Yasser was just a kind of a, you know, like, he's just a stand-in for, like, literally, you know, millions of Muslims around the world, right? Including myself, right? But I, as I mentioned, like, you know, I personally was, after 9/11, was like, it was a very difficult time, right? Like, just to be able to speak anything, you know, to be able to sort of like verbalize your particular critical take on what was happening around you. And so, yeah, so I was just using Yasser as a sort of an example, you know, of, and like I said, I mean, I started with Ahmadinejad and ended with Yasser because these are not easy figures, right? I'm not doing Reza Islan or Fareed Zakaria because that's just nonsense. You know, like to put that thing up, like, is just useless, right? Because they're not really doing anything. They're not being critical in their Muslim subjectivities. They're just, you know, I mean, you know what I mean. So, right. So it's really these difficult figures, right? These figures that are complicated, that are not easy to stomach, right? They are the test of whether we can have critical Muslims sort of in the public sphere, in the global public ministry, right? They are the real test. You know, Reza Aslan is not a test. You know, Linda Sarsour, she's a test, right? That's hard. Omar Ilhan, she's a test, right? So for me, like, those are the kinds of figures, right? I think I write in the other book, like, that if you look at the way, in the American context especially, look at the way, like, Black political activism and Black sort of critical engagement has shifted, right, over time, right? So we went from, like, say, in the 60s, you had movies like To Serve With Love, you know, and, like, just very sort of anodyne descriptions of Blacks are people too, right? To something like Get Out or Django Unchained, right, which is really sort of giving a space for Black critical anger, right, and righteousness, right? So I feel like something like that has to be on offer, right, for Muslims in this country and elsewhere, right, especially in the West, obviously, because without that, you just have this kind of, this continuing cycle of, like, the, you know, what I call sort of basementization of discourse, right? Everything goes to the basement, and then, you know, basements are not connected to each other. The basements are, like, you know, by definition, there is just only one place.
So as we're coming to the end of our time, Khurram, and you've sort of alluded to this also, but could you share a bit with our listeners? What's the, actually, you're sort of done with your second book also, but could you say a bit about that? And maybe what's the future hold in terms of what you're planning on working on?
Okay, so the next project I'm going to work on is this idea called, the tentative title is Love as a Political Idea. And I want to do this kind of use like a range of scholars in the last 150 years who ground a politics of love in some particular religious understanding, right? So I'm going to look at Iqbal, I'm going to look at Martin Buber, Hannah Arendt again, I'm going to look at maybe Fanon, right? So, like, just again doing something similar as to what I was doing here, which is sort of like just explore this idea of love, using sort of Jewish and Hindu, Muslim, different sort of varieties of folks, and to ground the love as a political idea, not, you know, as an active political idea. So that's the next project. The book that's finished now is basically was actually part of the same book that I then chopped into two. So the book that's coming out in October that you've read and reviewed, thank you. Basically looks at this commensurability thesis that I mentioned in Islamist Critique, the either or, right? Like the either friend or foe, and just expands that discussion to a book length discussion, right? Like, and how does that particular either or sort of operate in Western public discourses, right? And so that So that's, that book is finished. But I think I'm like sort of done with this particular phase of my scholarship, right? My Islam specific scholarship, I think, is coming to a temporary close, at least. You know, I think I'm going to be moving on to like sort of doing much more sort of comparative work, which is what I've been trained in.
Islam as a Critique, Syed Ahmad Khan and the Challenge of Modernity by Professor Khurram Hussain, published by Bloomsbury Press in 2020, and this was part of the Islam of the Global West series. Thank you so much, Khurram, for your time to come on the New Books Network. It's really been a pleasure to have you on, and thank you again for this wonderful and really provocative and important book that I'm sure.
No, thank you. Thank you, Sherry. This was really
read and debated.
It was great talking to you. Thank you so much.
So this was my conversation with Professor Khurram Hussain about his wonderful new book, Islam as Critique. I hope you enjoyed this episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. Until next time, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies.